second case this morning. That is Spivey versus Adaptive Marketing.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I am Mark Brown here on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant Quentin Spivey. We are here this morning on the appeal of a granting of summary judgment dismissing all of the claims in the case. And the facts of the case were recited, I think, extensively in the briefing. And because I will struggle here today to cover all the topics in 15 minutes, I'll avoid recitation of the facts unless the Court has specific questions. Otherwise, I'd like to begin where the District Court began in its summary judgment order, which is with the notion of caveat emptor. And it struck me as an ill-suited case to invoke the doctrine of caveat emptor. I'm not here today to challenge the wisdom of caveat emptor.
Well, and we do accept that there was an oral contract. Is that right? You accept that.
Yes, Your Honor. There's also
we go from there.
Correct, and so the doctrine is we also pleaded an unjust enrichment claim in the event that the Court were to find that there was no valid contract, in which case Mr. Spivey would have been charged without any authorization whatsoever. But certainly Adaptive produced a recording that they claim is an oral conversation with Mr. Spivey. He doesn't specifically recall it, but he doesn't dispute it either. And so effectively it's not disputed that there was an oral conversation, which plaintiffs contend would have created an oral agreement. The problem.
Well, and do you concede that there was an oral agreement at that stage?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there
whatever
was.
Whatever it was, the Atkins diet products.
Correct. Mr. Spivey made a phone call to purchase an Atkins diet product, and this was an upsell to a different product. But the difficulty that I have with the concept of applying caveat emptor here, to use the district court's example of the wild horse, of course it's reasonable to assume that to expect the buyer to assume the risk that a horse will turn out to be a wild horse. It's not, however, reasonable to expect, nor does the doctrine of caveat emptor imply, that the buyer assumes the risk that the seller will later demand double the price of the agreed-upon price. And I think what happened here is that, starting with caveat emptor as the starting point, it produced an absurd result here. And here's what I mean by this. Adaptive has argued strenuously that it is not bound by the terms of the oral agreement because there was no mutual assent, simply because Mr. Spivey does not recall specifically the phone conversation, even though there is an undisputed recording of that call, and even though the words used, I think, are not in genuine dispute. On the other hand, Adaptive argues that a subsequent written agreement with contradictory terms is enforceable, even though not only does Mr. Spivey not recall a subsequent written agreement, he argues vehemently that he did not receive it, didn't see it, certainly didn't sign it, and didn't do anything to acknowledge it in any way.
At one point, that he may have received it.
As a theoretical possibility, Your Honor, I think that's true. That answer came in a long line of questions which are actually...
Well, at one time he said he may have received it.
Well, what he said is that there's a theoretical possibility. He testified at length about his process at his home that his family employs for reading their mail. He testified extensively that he reads every piece of mail. He and his wife have a filing system that they used. If he had received anything from Adaptive, he would have created a file for it. He has none. His mailbox was locked and required a key to open it. At the time the written agreement was allegedly sent, his children were young and so therefore could not have diverted the mail.
Is it undisputed that after a year he was billed for another year's whatever it was from Adaptive? And that it was paid on his credit card?
I do not believe that that is in dispute, what? Your Honor. No, you're correct, Your Honor. That is not in dispute. He did pay his credit card bill each year.
It was higher than the original.
Pardon me?
It was higher than it was the first year.
That is correct. And that pertains to one of the issues that I'll touch upon, which is the voluntary payment doctrine. Mr. Spivey believed his wife is a school teacher, and he, upon seeing Homeworks Plus, on his bill, assumed that his wife had purchased a homework-related product for school, and it wasn't until he asked her whether she was going to be reimbursed that by the school that he learned that, no, this is not a purchase his wife had made.
Did it happen 2 years?
He was...
Twice he paid, the credit card was used to pay a higher fee 1 year, and then the following year another higher fee?
It was multiple years, Your Honor. I believe that the first charge was in 2003, and that was $96. The next charge in 2004, I believe, was $149, and then he was charged 2 additional years in the amount of $199.
And then finally the dispute appeared. And
correct. He saw the bill, and again, the question in his mind that put him on notice that his assumption was incorrect is when he asked his wife whether she was going to be reimbursed for this charge. And
how many years did it take him to speak to his wife? We have a lot of husbands and wives that don't speak to each other today.
I don't. That's a funny question that way. I think he mentioned that he had seen this in previous years. He didn't know which years, and he couldn't say exactly how many years. So I don't know if he saw it in year one and didn't ask her about it until year four, or whether he saw it in year three and didn't ask her about it until year four.
But doesn't he have a duty to examine his credit card statements?
First of all, I don't believe that there is any case law that Adaptive has cited, and certainly none that I'm aware of, creating a duty to review third-party credit card statements. But I will say this, that the cases that talk about a duty to investigate based on invoices and materials that are received indicate that if there is such a duty, it arises from something within the documents themselves that would indicate that there is reason to investigate. So, for example, in the Harris case that's been cited where there were invoices sent for copying, it would have been apparent from the invoices that there was an overcharge, and had those invoices been reviewed carefully, there would have been a reason to know that follow-up questioning may have been in order. In this case, however, the only information that was provided, not even by Adaptive, but provided by the credit card company, was the name AP9 Homeworks Plus, which, by the way, is not a term that was used in the script that was read to Mr. Spivey. So this is a new terminology, number one. Number two, there is simply an 800 telephone number to call if there are questions. But there's nothing inherent.
Did he receive products each year?
He did not. And that really is the rub here, Your Honor.
Did he receive?
Nothing. He received an Atkins diet product from someone, a completely separate company. Ostensibly, what Adaptive does is it provides for these memberships that they sell, they provide discount coupons that can be used in retail stores. Mr. Spivey received none of those, and I think his testimony on that is very clear. So the only thing
that would have been in the kit that he was supposed to get?
Well, theoretically, there would have been some instruction in the kit. There's some testimony from Adaptive about differing information at different time in the kits. At one point, it was simply a postcard that was sent. But in any event, presumably the kit would have contained information about how to use coupons in year one if that had been received. Mr. Spivey did claims not to have received it in year one or any of the subsequent years. So the only thing that Mr. Spivey ever received from Adaptive is a credit card bill, a credit card charge. He didn't even receive the bill from Adaptive. He received that from his credit card company.
Which he did have for 3 or 4 years and paid. Is that right?
That is true, Your Honor. His credit card bills were paid, and that's certainly not in dispute. I think the legal dispute here, the question is whether he was under some obligation to investigate the reasonableness of his own assumption that this was a product of his wife had purchased for school. And I think the district court certainly didn't determine that assumption was unreasonable. And I don't think Adaptive has argued that assumption was unreasonable. Adaptive has not argued that assumption and that mistake of fact was not a genuine mistake on Mr. Spivey's part. So if the court is asking whether there should be some sort of duty for spousal interrogation of credit card bills, I would hope that's not where we're headed. Certainly I don't think that, you know, perhaps if this were not something that seems so innocuous for a school teacher to possibly have purchased, it might be different. But I think it's a reasonable mistake on his part, and I think there was nothing in the credit card bills themselves that would have created a duty for further investigation.
The phone call he made was to get the diet product from
it. Yes, Your Honor.
And this was a West or whatever the name was sort of a third party that set that up, and also then the Adaptive was part of their program where they'd add that on to it.
That is generally my understanding, Your Honor. I'm not sure whether West takes the initial. I can't recall whether West takes the initial call regarding the diet product, or whether that call is then transferred to West after the diet product is purchased. We don't have a recording of that part of the transaction. The only recording that was produced pertains to the Adaptive.
And I'm sorry, your answer to Justice O'Connor's question, he did get the Atkins product, the diet product?
I believe he did.
You know, you noted that the scripts have now been revised to let callers know that the membership renewal fees can be increased after the first year at then current rate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can we consider such a subsequent remedial measure?
Well, I think I wouldn't view it as a subsequent remedial measure. I think it may be parole evidence to resolve an ambiguity about prior language in the scripts, if there is such an ambiguity. Here's what I would say in addition about that, though. Your Honor, the original script was very clear that Mr. Spivey would authorize just $96 annually. And the district court's position was that because there's no what the district court called static price guarantee, that the undisputed fact that Mr. Spivey was charged more than just $96 annually was not a breach of the oral agreement. The problem with that analysis, Your Honor, is that it completely disregards the dictionary definition of the word annually. By the way, the script we've cited in our opening brief at pages 5 to 6, and we've also produced a recording, which I'd encourage the court to listen to if they haven't had that opportunity. That's Appendix 526, and it's a CD. What was described in the script is that after 30 days, the service is extended to a full year for just $8 per month, just $96 annually. Billed in advance as homeworks to the credit card you're using today. You will be charged the annual fee at the end of your 30-day trial period and at the beginning of each new membership year. So by what the court disregarded, the Black's Law Dictionary definition of annually, when Mr. Spivey was told he would be charged just $96 annually, the dictionary definition would mean that he would be charged just $96 yearly, every year, year by year. The court completely disregarded that dictionary definition, did not provide any contrary dictionary definition, did not say that application of that dictionary definition would be unreasonable in this case. And Adaptive argues that annually, when it says you'll be charged just $96 annually, they can charge whatever they want in subsequent years, and the word annual only means that the renewal fees will be once a year. But that begs the question, what was meant in the scripts when it said that you will be charged the annual fee at the end of your 30-day trial period and at the beginning of each new membership year? What could the annual fee mean if not the $96 referenced in the previous sentence? And so in terms of the subsequent, I think this language is relatively unambiguous if you apply the dictionary definition. At worst, it's ambiguous, in which case I believe that either it should be construed against Adaptive or as the drafter, or submitted to the jury for consideration of parole evidence, which I think answers Judge Roedner's question about the subsequent scripts. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Bulls.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Nader Bulas for Adaptive Marketing. Also, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Mr. Troy Bozarth. Your Honor, I'd like to first start where Mr. Brown left off, which was the assertion that the oral contract that they allege to have been created in the call is ambiguous. And the point I'd like to make there before moving on to some of the other points that Your Honors just raised is that Mr. Spivey has actually testified. It was undisputed, his testimony was, that in his view, that language was not ambiguous. We asked him that exact question. I point to page 82 of our response appendix, and he looked at the language in the script and said, I agree, that doesn't say anything about the price being unchanging. So I think that in and of itself addresses the notion that there's any ambiguity, let alone ambiguity that would be sufficient to create a jury question here. I'd like to start by focusing on the voluntary payment doctrine, because I think the Court correctly began the questioning there. It is really a dispositive issue here, as the district court found. There's no dispute that if Mr. Spivey accepts that the call did occur, just judging from the script itself, he was offered a trial membership in the Homeworks program. He was told written material would follow. He was told that at the beginning of the call when the telemarketer said, we are sending you a membership. Again, at the end of the call when the telemarketer said, look for your kit in the mail. The membership materials themselves had an approve or reject mechanism, which this Court has considered many times. But as is particularly important for the voluntary payment issue, and nowhere addressed in the appellant's brief or argument, he was also told in the call, it will be billed to your credit card as Homeworks. And that is really the start and end of the voluntary payment issue, because the entire argument here, factually, has proceeded from this notion that when he received credit card bills, as it is undisputed he did each year, 2003, 04, 05, 06, and 07, the entire premise of the appellant's position has been he couldn't figure out what he was being charged for. We have to begin from the undisputed premise, though, that in the call he was told, you will be billed as Homeworks. And in every year, in fact, he was billed as Homeworks. Now, there's this reference made in argument to the fact that some of the credit card charges had AP9 at the beginning. That's a payment processing code used all the time by different sorts of vendors.
What's that? You repeat that. I don't understand what you're saying.
It is a payment processing code, Your Honor. My understanding is that Visa, as an administrative matter, requires that to be present.
Requires what?
The legend AP9.
AP9.
Correct.
So that appeared on his Visa bill?
Yes. The line item for the charge read AP9 and then Homeworks as referenced in the call.
AP9-Homeworks is what appeared?
Correct. I don't think there was a dash. I believe it was a space. But AP9 followed by Homeworks followed by the toll-free number. So Homeworks exactly as he was told during the call, and then the toll-free number that he ultimately did avail himself of.
Was the toll-free number on each of the items on the bill? each year?
Yes. Every time he was billed for Homeworks, it said Homeworks, and every time he was billed for Homeworks, it also included the toll-free number. And, Justice O'Connor, your questions to the appellant focused, I think, correctly on how long he paid those bills before inquiring about them. I think the record is clear. The first time he made any inquiry was 2007, or the first time, in his words, he noticed them. You derive that from the complaint where he alleged that. It's, I believe, paragraph 25 of the original complaint, repeated paragraph 25 of the first amended complaint. It's repeated, in fact, in the appellant's opening brief here at page 5, very first line of his statement of facts says, in January 2007, Mr. Spivey noticed a charge. Now, there's also been some testimony cited in the reply papers suggesting that he may have noticed it 1 or 2 years earlier. I think the fair reading of that testimony is that when he noticed it in 2007, as he testified and as he, in fact, pled, he then looked back at his last year's bill. But ultimately, that's not material or relevant, because if one were to grant that he had noticed it in 2006, it still is undisputed he paid in 03, 04, the first year in which the prices were increased, and 05, every time with it billed exactly as it had been described, and every time with a toll-free number. Under the Illinois cases that we've cited in our papers, the voluntary payment doctrine has teeth. It means something. It serves important purposes, not just protecting payees and achieving finality in transactions, but also promoting early resolution of disputes, avoiding litigation where it's unnecessary. And I think those purposes really come home to roost here when you look back again to the call transcript in which it was explained to him that there is a 1 year, no questions asked. There was a 30-day initial trial period, and the telemarketer went on to say, if you don't save hundreds of dollars in your first year, just call and you'll get a full refund.
You know, is it your position that if we listen to the recording on the record and clearly hear that the telemarketer said the annual fee and not an annual fee, that we have to ignore this fact?
No, it is not. It is not. I think ultimately...
But it's not. It's not clear?
It is, in our view, it is clear.
On it said an or the?
Our view is that it said an. And this is contemporaneous. There's been, again, a suggestion. This is sort of a gotcha. I would point out, we, in our first pleadings in the case, set out our transcript of the call. We then cited that in our summary judgment papers, which are in the appendix at page 326. We thought it said an. Mr. Spivey thought it said an in his complaint and his amended complaint, also testified that it said an, and this notably, that deposition testimony came after our summary judgment briefs had been filed. So all the cards were on the table.
When you were provided the recording, was there a transcript that accompanied it?
No, the transcripts have all been created by people listening to the recording. So, but to get back to Your Honor's question, ultimately, it doesn't matter whether it was an or the. It doesn't matter to the outcome of this summary judgment motion. First, because there is clear Seventh Circuit authority, Pro CD versus Seidenberg, Hill versus Gateway, Boomer versus AT&T, that says, when you provide an accept or reject mechanism, that is legally binding. That's the law of this circuit. It is for good reason, as this court has explained. It promotes efficiency, standardization, allows these sorts of transactions to occur. And to create the exception that the appellant requests in this case would completely undermine that. I do want to address...
Of course, the pro-CD case is very different.
I will grant
you
that,
know,
Your Honor.
You've got a fellow opening a product, using it. You know, here there was no physical product to open. There's nothing to indicate in the record that any product was ever used. I mean, isn't it a bit disconcerting to say that both silence and inaction bind a person to a contract? Do you understand? You know,
I do, Your Honor.
Yeah, in other words, you know, you're sending out contracts, and what you're saying in them is, if you say nothing and do nothing, we will have assumed that you have consented to the terms of this contract. And, I mean, if the telephone conversation didn't bind the parties in an oral contract, then what did bind Spivey to the contract? Silence? Inaction? What? What?
Yeah, the telephone conversation, as you put your finger on, really is the first step. But it's important to recognize what the telephone conversation was. It was the offer of a trial period with written material to follow. And if then the consumer elected to continue after the trial period, it would be a full membership. The practice, standard practice, as we've cited in the record, was then to send written materials. And the sources for that evidence of practice, which goes to the mailbox rule question that I think came up in the opening questioning, the sources of that are, first, the company's best practices as a matter of corporate policy, say, to mail disclosures with all initial memberships and with renewals. Second, there is a contractual obligation in cases like this where memberships are marketed by West. Third, there was testimony from Ms. Muller, one of the marketing directors at the company, saying that it is Adaptive's obligation to fulfill, that is, send the membership materials, and that its practice on all trial memberships is to immediately send out fulfillment materials.
What is he paying for here? He doesn't get any product. He doesn't get any. What exactly?
He's paying for membership in a discount club that gives him access to discounts. And those discounts come in the membership kit that's mailed initially and every year. It's up to the consumer to decide whether or not to use them. So, but he's paying for the access.
So you're saying that every single year of all those years he received a kit?
Correct. Correct. And to go back to one
of
the questions.
He's saying he doesn't recall if he ever got a kit.
That's correct. He is saying that. Now, under Boomer and Godfrey, we presented evidence of our undisputed procedure practice of mailing them. The comment was made in the appellant's opening argument that there was a theoretical possibility he didn't receive it. It isn't theoretical with respect. It is pled as a matter of fact in his complaint and amended complaint, paragraph 31, that yes, he may have received it. His testimony then, simply at the end of the day, comes out exactly the same place. He doesn't remember it, but he may have received it. There is no case that the appellant has cited that says where there is evidence of a regular procedure of mailing, but the recipient doesn't recall it, that the mailing presumption is overcome. And that would make the presumption self-defeating. It, I would submit, cannot be the rule. With that, I see my time is up, unless Your Honors have any additional questions.
You still have a couple minutes.
I apologize. I've misread the lights then. With my last couple of minutes, I want to go back to the question of the written contract, what makes it binding. I started from the proposition that the call sets up this trial period followed by an approve or reject mechanism. The next question is receipt, and I think I've addressed that there is undisputed evidence of a practice of mailing the materials, and there is no evidence to create a genuine issue of any material fact on receipt sufficient to overcome that showing under Boomer.
But there is conflicting testimony as to whether he received the welcome kit and threw it away, never received the mailing at all, cannot recall whether he received it. Why aren't those fact issues?
Because his testimony admits of all those possibilities, and once those possibilities exist, it is as a matter of law insufficient to overcome the presumption of mailing. I think the court's decision in Godfrey is instructive here on the question of just what would overcome a presumption of mailing. The court there in footnote 3 pointed to a couple of different scenarios. One was based on the Doolin case, said if you have some evidence of misleading address, some sort of error in the addressing. Another was based on the McPartland decision and said if you know, for instance, that it was sent out with a receipt, with a return receipt, and the sender never got a return receipt back. So these are cases where there is some presentation of evidence. It's not ipsy-dixit, and certainly not an ipsy-dixit that admits of many possibilities, as we had here. Once you move past that threshold issue of mailing, on which I would suggest there is no genuine dispute of material fact, you are now squarely within the ambit of Zeidenberg Pro CD, which this court then clarified in Hill was not limited to the so-called click wrap.
Even though Pro CD and Hill surely are distinguishable. In that the purchasers, you know, had to go into a store, or they had to go online, they had to purchase a product, they had to receive a receipt or invoice, they had to open a product with warranties and instruction papers and then use it. He didn't go into a store or online. He didn't hand anyone cash or a credit card or type in his numbers or promise later payment or... He didn't open a package. He didn't get an invoice or a receipt. He didn't use a product.
Well, he
That's
did do...
pretty different.
There are some factual differences, but on the core facts, there really are none. As in Gateway, where the consumer called Gateway, ordered a computer, here, Mr. Spivey called a telemarketer, ordered a product, gave his credit card number, then listened to an offer of a trial period and decided to elect it. And I'd point out there... He actually, it's undisputed, listened to two trial offers, one for Homeworks, indicated he would like to go forward with that trial period, one for another program called Galleria. He said, I don't think I'd use that, and he was never billed for it.
Well, you seem to think that when he said okay, that was a promise to pay later, right?
Correct. It was an indication of assent to the trial period, which would then be followed by a full membership if he did not cancel the trial period, and only then would he be billed. I see now I'm reading the right lights correctly, Your Honors. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present the case.
Mr. Brown? Brown, you have 1 minute.
Your Honor, Hill versus Gateway, not only is it factually very distinguishable, it's also distinguishable in a very important legal way, and that is Hill versus Gateway dealt with contract formation and the circumstances under which contracts may be formed. It did not deal with modification of an existing contract and circumstances by which contradictory terms can be imposed on someone by silence. regarding the notion that Mr. Spivey did not recall receiving a kit in the mail, I want to be very clear. His testimony wasn't that he didn't recall whether or not he did, maybe he did or maybe he didn't. I think the way that testimony came up was he didn't recall receiving a kit. How could you possibly recall receiving something that you didn't receive? It wasn't 50-50. He may have received it, he may not have. He just didn't remember. He went through extensive testimony about his mail procedures. And in terms of the voluntary payment doctrine, recall that the district court denied, I think rightly so, Adaptive's motion to dismiss on the voluntary payment doctrine because the court said that if Mr. Spivey was in fact mistaken about Homeworks Plus being a product that his wife purchased, then that's sufficient to overcome the voluntary payment doctrine. The facts of this case did not change between the time of the ruling on the motion to dismiss and the summary judgment. The facts have remained exactly the same, and I think that mistake of fact, at a minimum, is a jury issue.
I think I missed something. Is Mr. Boulos correct that he was told by the telemarketer this will be billed as something called homework?
It does say you will be billed to your credit card as Homeworks. It did not say AP9 Homeworks, and it did not say AP9 Homeworks Plus. And recall that this conversation occurred in 2003. What gave rise to this this action occurred in 2007. So essentially that argument would require Mr. Spivey to have recalled a very brief conversation from 2003. And until this case arose and this recording was produced in discovery, he didn't even remember that he had purchased an Atkins diet product. So for him to... Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.